Right. So the fundamental thrust of this talk is going to be, given the increasingly urgent need for reliable climate predictions of the future climate, and given the fact that even the most powerful supercomputers we have are still not powerful enough to integrate the equations on more than a very coarse grid, and given also that most of the uncertainty in future climate projections, the uncertainty in the climate sensitivity, comes from the basic fact that we simply don't know properly how to represent the impacts of the unresolved processes, the sub-grid scale processes. Given all of these things, is there anything we can learn from watching, observing in the laboratory on a much smaller scale some of these unresolved processes, and in particular, can we learn anything which will help us inform the process of parameterization, the process of representing the unresolved processes in climate models? There'll be various people to thank along the way, but let me begin by acknowledging the UK's Natural Environment Research Council, which funds my present research through its fellowship scheme, and the Walker Institute for Climate System Research at Reading University in the UK, which is hosting my fellowship. And there's going to be, sort of in response to what we discussed yesterday, there's going to be a large tutorial component to this talk. So I'll spend quite a long time on the introduction, the motivation. I'm actually going to focus the question down to the subject of gravity waves and think about what are the potential impacts of gravity waves on the resolved scale circulation. And then I'm going to look at two case studies which demonstrate the importance of unresolved gravity waves in the climate system. Firstly, for the oceanographers amongst us, I'm going to think about the role that unresolved gravity waves play in maintaining the thermohaline circulation. And it turns out that they play a critical role, actually. And then I'll look at a case study in the atmosphere, for the atmospheric dynamicists, and that's looking at a potential role for unresolved gravity waves in triggering southern stratospheric warmings. And I'll say what those are shortly, and wrap up with some conclusions. So, sort of basic fact then, which motivates the whole talk, is the reason why climate simulation is hard. And the reason why climate simulation is hard is because we are simply not capable of exactly solving the governing partial differential equations, including the Navier-Stokes equations, of the climate system. Even with the most powerful supercomputers available to us, we have to project the exact continuous equations onto a very coarse grid, and that is the fundamental reason why climate simulation is difficult. It's also the reason why it's interesting, actually, I think, as well. Anyway, I think that this point's made very well by one of my favourite cartoons. Shows the partial differential equations as these two people, and the general circulation model is this big sharp knife that comes down and sort of cuts them. Slightly gory cartoon decapitation going on, and lots of blood. But anyway, it sort of makes the point, which I think makes it quite well, is that the equations that we solve when we try to simulate the climate are not the exact continuous partial differential equations, but they're some highly truncated, cut-up, discretized version. And that's why climate simulation is hard. And the implication, and this is a sort of Anglo-centric
slide. Why not?
Sorry about that. it just makes the point that the typical grid boxes we use for a sort of century-long climate simulation are about this sort of size compared to the UK. So anything, any climatic process, and there are many important climatic processes which take place on a smaller scale than these grid boxes, are not explicitly captured by the model. Okay, so GCMs, general circulation models, can't resolve many of the most important processes in the climate system for this reason. And despite our very best efforts at approximately representing or parameterizing the impacts of these unresolved processes in climate models, they're still result large systematic climate biases, and this is just an example of one of them. This is sea surface temperature, a century mean sea surface temperature simulated by one of the world's leading coupled atmosphere ocean general circulation models, the SINTEX GCM. The atmosphere is the ECMWF Hamburg ECAM 4. The ocean is one of the French ocean GCMs, OPA. So we run a control integration for 100 years and take a century mean, and this, and then subtract away observed sea surface temperatures from the Levitas observations, and we end up with these really quite large, up to 5 degrees Celsius, systematic climate errors. And these result essentially from the fact that there are unresolved processes and we don't know exactly how to resolve them, parameterize them approximately. And this is the impact. And
so of course, this is a model minus climate or climate minus model?
This is model minus observations. So it's 5 degrees too warm here in the tropical Atlantic.
Most people is cold. It's cold time. This is kind of opposite.
This is just a bias. It's not the mean, right?
That's
just
right.
Saying,
yeah. I mean, I could.
Warm.
Yeah.
Usually, it's cold town. It's been too far, so it's cold vibes. It's the warm vibes.
Whatever the look that was to do.
I don't know the reason for that. I think this pattern would look quite. Well, I guess it would have similarities amongst different GCMs. But anyway, just so make the basic.
How do we really judge whether this is good or bad?
It's bad.
I mean, yeah. Of course, we're never going to get it to be zero everywhere, so there's you always have to define some tolerance and some threshold for it being bad, but I agree with Paul, it's pretty bad.
Some are better. I mean, you have in the Gulf Stream, for example, it looks like just the trajectory isn't quite right, so it doesn't separate quite at the right spots.
Right.
That's not necessarily disastrous up there, it's
right.
Just that the stream is displaced a bit and looks like a big difference.
Right, that's his dipole. It's,
yeah.
Yeah.
You want to be within a couple of degrees, 2 degrees.
Right. Especially if you want to talk
it's
about...
It's reasonable to expect that.
Right. If you want accurate future climate predictions, the sort of basic prerequisite, I think, is to get the current climate right. And the IPCC recognises this, and they have to update this, actually. This is from their third assessment report. But they say that to understand and characterise, essentially better parameterise, the important unresolved processes in the climate system is a high priority area for action. And I guess they make a similar comment in the fourth assessment report. I haven't actually looked through it. I'd be surprised if something like that wasn't there. So this is just a sort of not very comprehensive list of some of the unresolved processes in general circulation models in the atmosphere. Clouds, a sort of major topic that kept coming up again and again last week at the conference, was the role of clouds and the role that they play in injecting uncertainty. Turbulence, especially in the boundary layer and orography, mountains, subgrid scale mountains. In the ocean eddies, which contain well over 90% of the kinetic energy of the ocean, that are unresolved in ocean GCMs. Turbulence, especially in the mixed layer. Boundary currents are much more narrow than the grid spacing. And in both the atmosphere and the ocean, convection, especially deep convection in the ocean. And gravity waves, and in fact I'm going to focus on gravity waves now for the rest of the talk. People have given a lot of attention to clouds and the role that they play in uncertainty. I guess it's not unreasonable to say that gravity waves have been slightly neglected, I think, and so I'm going to try and point out some important aspects of the impacts of gravity waves on climate. And I've sort of built up a bit of a collection of pictures of gravity waves over the years, and these are a few of my favourites. Gravity waves in the atmosphere. This photo was taken in Sweden. These are noctilucent clouds. Taken in my street in Reading. The bottom left is the classic Whitehill ship wake problem. Any moving object here in the ocean generates a wake of gravity waves. Of course, there are internal gravity waves deep in the ocean, as well as gravity waves at the surface, and I'll talk a lot more about internal gravity waves later in the talk. The southeast coast here of the US, a satellite picture, and the train of gravity waves. And in the bottom right, just to show that this is not a problem limited to Earth's geofluids, this is a picture of Mars taken by the Mars Global Surveyor. This is Korolev Crater sticking its head up into the clouds. And there is a westerly flow here, so a west to east flow generating this train of gravity waves in its wake. So gravity waves are pretty ubiquitous in the atmospheres and oceans of the Earth and other planets. This may be a bit dumbed down for this audience. I use it for teaching, but so I thought I'd put it in. So, I mean, what are these gravity waves? If you write down the fluid equations, the Navier-Stokes equations, or shallow water equations on a rotating sphere, in fact, in any rotating coordinate system, in a rotating channel, for example, if you write down the equations and compute the eigenmodes, you find out that at the sort of parameter space which the ocean and the atmosphere explore, that the eigenmodes of those equations fall into two distinct categories. You get gravity waves, relatively high frequency, short scale, fast, quickly propagating waves for which the divergence exceeds the relative vorticity. It's the defining characteristic of these waves. And so this is one category of eigenmodes, the Navier-Stokes equations on a rotating sphere. The other are the Rossby waves.
This is really using Wisniewski approximations. It doesn't really matter which type of Wisniewski.
Right, that's correct. This is a very generic property of the equations. And you also get the Rossby waves. These are the second category. And these are much larger in scale than the gravity waves, much more slowly evolving, lower frequency, relative vorticity, much bigger than the horizontal divergence. And so I'm just sort of representing the Rossby waves as being the low frequency, the low notes on a piano, the gravity waves as being the high notes. And I'm just making the basic point, which students seem to like, that trying to simulate the atmosphere or the ocean using a discretized grid, a GCM grid, is a little bit like trying to play a music on this piano where the top few octaves are broken. You press these notes and no sound comes out because these are the unresolved subgrid scale, high frequency notes in our GCM. And there's a nice quote, it's from in a letter from Jules Charney to Philip Thompson in 1947. It says that we might say that the atmosphere is a musical instrument on which we can play many tunes, and nature is a musician more of the Beethoven than of the Chopin type. In other words, nature puts a lot of energy into the Rossby waves and relatively little energy into the gravity waves. Play Beethoven, think of the piano sonatas, for example, there's a lot of energy going into these notes and not much going in above middle C. Contrast that with Chopin, the ballads or the fantasy impromptu, the nocturnes, a lot more energy in these notes above middle C, for those of you who know Beethoven and Chopin. And so we're sort of fortunate that nature is a bit more like Beethoven and putting most of its energy, this is the minus 5/3 of the minus 3 energy spectrum. Most of the energy is going into the Rossby waves. If nature was more inclined to the Chopin type, then it wouldn't be a minus 3 or a minus 5/3 energy spectrum. It might be a minus 1 or maybe k to the 0, a flat energy spectrum with as much energy up here as down here. And then we might really be in trouble when it comes to parameterization, because these waves would be energetically much more important than, in fact, they are. So there's not much energy in these waves, although that still does not mean that that the problem is solved. It just means that energetically these gravity waves are less important than the Rossby wave modes. Right, so here are some pertinent questions then about gravity waves. Firstly, just the basic question, does it actually matter that gravity waves are not resolved in... Actually, I'm thinking mainly about climate here, but the same question you can ask about weather models. Because it might just not matter. I mean, these waves are energetically minor compared to the Rossby, the large-scale balanced vortical modes. So maybe it just doesn't matter. And another way of asking that question is, do the gravity waves interact with the resolved flow? Perhaps they don't. Perhaps they're essentially linear waves, and there's no coupling between the gravity waves and the resolved flow, so the gravity waves evolve independently and uncoupled from the resolved scale flow. You could make a good argument that that would be the case, just based on the scale separation by a factor of at least 10, both in space and in time, between the short-scale gravity waves and the larger-scale motions of meteorological interest. In fact, I'm going to show that the answer to both of these questions is yes, it does matter. And gravity waves do interact with the resolved flow. And then the next question is, can the interaction be parameterized? In other words, is there an approximate way of writing down, of closing the equations by writing down formula for the impacts of the gravity waves on the larger scale flow deterministically? And I'm going to show you an example of a case where the answer to this question is no. There are circumstances in which the interaction between gravity waves and the larger scale flow cannot be parameterized, at least not deterministically. And I'll use that to motivate stochastic or statistical techniques for parameterization. And here's the big question, really. How do we even begin to go about answering these questions? They're quite tricky questions to answer. Certainly can't use a GCM to answer them because we can't run the thing at high enough resolution. We could go and make field observations in the atmosphere and the ocean of gravity waves and try and look at their impacts. But that's not a perfect solution either because, you know, we can't control the atmosphere or the ocean. We can't do repeatable, reproducible experiments. The atmosphere and ocean just evolve in the way that they evolve, and we can't rewind time and, you know, carry out controlled experiments. We just get what we get. So I'm going to suggest that one way of finding answers to these questions is to look at a much smaller scale in the laboratory.
So since you mentioned this 10 orders of magnitude separation, if we go another 10 orders and go to sound waves, is it known, does the sound waves spectrum?
10 orders of magnitude
is a factor thing.
So if we go many more orders of magnitude, we get the sound waves. Is it known, does the spectrum peak anywhere in the atmosphere?
So it turns out that the condition for an interaction between two scale separated waves. So if you have a large scale wave and a small scale wave coexisting, which I guess is the general situation we're talking about, turns out, due to a paper by Benny in 1977, that the condition for these two modes, the short scale wave and the large scale wave, to exchange energy is not that the wavelengths have to match or that the time scales or the frequencies have to match. It's that the group speed of the small short wave has to match the phase speed of the long wave. So the resonance condition is not, it's got nothing to do with the spatial extents or the frequencies of the waves. It's actually that the phase speed of the large scale wave has to match the group speed of the short scale wave. The physical interpretation is that the energy in the short scale waves is not drifting with respect to the phase lines of the large scale wave. And I think for sound waves you can't match that condition. But if this is a gravity wave and this is a velocity wave, you can match that. So I'm going to call now on a property of the Navier-Stokes equations called dynamical similarity. This is simply that this is a laboratory tank, an annular tank about 20 centimeters across, and this is a rotating planet. Actually, when you write down the example of the Navier-Stokes equations or quasi-geostrophic equations, they actually look very similar for the fluid in this tank and the fluid trapped between these latitude circles. So the balance of forces on a moving fluid parcel can be the same in a rotating annulus and in a rotating planet if the non-dimensional parameters, the Rossby number, the Reynolds number, the Richardson number, and so on, are the same. And we can engineer a laboratory experiment so that those non-dimensional parameters are the same. And so, you know, my plan then for the rest of the talk is to, you know, we're interested in learning something about, you've seen this picture before, we're interested in learning something about the impacts of these gravity waves and also the same waves in the ocean on the larger scale circulation, the resolved flow. And I'm going to try and learn something about that mechanism by looking at these gravity waves in the laboratory. So this is looking down this rotation axis on the laboratory experiment. These are some gravity waves. You see the similarity? And despite the fact that the wavelength here is only about a centimeter, much, much larger here, despite that fact, when you non-dimensionalize the governing equations, they look the same. So we can, I mean, the way I think about these laboratory experiments is essentially they're solving the Navier-Stokes equations exactly at infinite resolution. I mean, it's a bit like an infinitely powerful computer doing a laboratory experiment. Okay, no numerical approximations, no finite truncation. It's essentially solving the equations exactly for us.
These are surface waves in the lab, though, right?
Right.
Or stratification.
There is stratification. This is actually a two-layer experiment. So these are internal.
Is it rotating as well?
Yeah, it's rotating.
What's the deformation scale?
It's about, I think you fit 3 or 4 deformation radii across the gap here, so it's a centimetre or two. So, this is, taking longer than I thought, a little case study of gravity waves, and there's a bit more of a tutorial coming up here. But I'm going to look at deep ocean mixing and thermohaline circulation, thanks to Tom Hain, who's an oceanographer at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, and Peter Reed, who's a fluid dynamicist at Oxford. I hardly need to put this up, but this is sort of schematic of the thermohaline circulation in the Atlantic. This warm current coming up, evaporating highly to the atmosphere and becoming colder as well, and eventually becoming so dense, these points approximately, these squares, that it sinks down towards the bottom of the ocean and returns as this deep current back southwards down the Atlantic. I just want to think about some basics of ocean energetics. This is very basic ocean physics here. This deep water formation, the sinking at high northern latitudes of dense surface waters, acts so as to reduce the ocean's potential energy. I'm just going to do an energy budget for the global ocean circulation here. The thermohaline circulation involves this deep water formation, and because you have sinking deep, dense waters and they're displacing lighter waters, the net effect is that the ocean's potential energy is reduced by this process.
Do people speak of available potential energy in the ocean?
Right, yes. And I'll come on to that. That's relevant for the next point. So the point is the barophilic instability, the mechanism by which barophilic eddies are generated, also reduces the available potential energy. So barophilic instability takes isopycnal surfaces of constant density, which slope in the ocean, and barophilic instability tends to flatten those surfaces, make them more horizontal, and that releases available potential energy into kinetic energy, which is the kinetic energy of the eddies. So there are these two processes in the ocean which act to reduce its potential or available potential energy. But of course, the ocean is not, we don't observe the ocean to be forever losing its potential energy. The averaged over a long enough time scale, the ocean is in a steady state, its potential energy is constant. You look over a long enough average. So we infer the existence of another mechanism which must be resupplying the lost potential energy due to deep water formation of the barophilic generation of eddies. Okay, we imagine a balance between the sinks of potential energy, deep water formation, and the eddy generation process, and a supply of potential energy. And that supply mechanism is vertical mixing. So if you have a stratified fluid, so I'm thinking about light water overlying dense water. Okay, the center of mass of this fluid is going to be not coincident with the center of volume, but slightly displaced towards the heavier fluid. Okay, and if we perfectly mix these two fluids vertically to come up with a homogeneous fluid, the center of mass would now be coincident with the center of volume, so this, by mixing this stratified fluid, we've raised the center of mass, raised the center of gravity, so we've raised the potential energy. Whenever you vertically mix a stratified fluid, you are raising its potential energy. You have to put work, put energy in to get that to happen. This mixing doesn't happen spontaneously. You have to inject energy to make the mixing happen and increase the potential energy of the system. So this vertical mixing is the process that is balancing the loss of potential energy by these two mechanisms. And the vertical mixing is achieved, it's a kind of long chain here of arguments, the vertical mixing is achieved by breaking internal gravity waves. So there are gravity waves on isopycnal surfaces, and they, you know, look like that, but eventually they break, so can't really draw a breaking wave. I guess it looks something like that, and eventually the wave breaks and you get mixing in the vertical due to the gravity wave. So these gravity...
It's a different picture from sort of the classical Stoller picture. It's really differential heating on the surface.
In the original Stommel model, he has a wonderful little propeller blade.
Right.
This is the propeller blade.
I think it's a bit of a confusing way of putting it, I think. You do have differential heating, and you have in particular wind stresses, and the wind stresses give Ekman transports that increase the slope of the isopycnals.
Right.
If nothing else happens. That generates potential energy on a large scale, Lettenberg kinetic eddies and so forth, circulation in general, convert to kinetic energy. The kinetic energy is what is being dissipated by the mixing. So I find it confusing just to state that the mixing is a source of energy or supplies potential energy in any way. It's really the sink of kinetic energy in the energy cycle. And the large scale energy does come from the large scale forcing, which is wind stress.
I'm coming on to that. My next question is going to be, what generates these waves in the first place?
Yeah.
There is some mechanism generating these waves, and the energy that goes into generating these waves ultimately is the energy that goes into mixing in the vertical, and thereby replenishing the potential energy that gets lost here. And Helen Johnson, who's an oceanographer at Reading, has put some of these effects you mentioned into this Stommel model and sort of expanded the Stommel model to include that we've talked about, I think. So there are two different ways of looking at the thermohaline circulation. There's the Stommel model, which is a buoyancy-driven thermohaline circulation. There's another model due to Nanadesican, I think is how to pronounce it. And you can blend these two models together and sort of reconcile them, which I think it may be what related to some of those issues. Anyway, it's not what I want to talk about. And it's been known, to go on, it's been known for about 100 years that if there was no vertical mixing in the ocean, okay, if you cut off this resupply of lost potential energy, that in fact there'd be no thermohaline circulation, and I guess no baryonic generation of eddies. The whole ocean would fill with uniformly cold, motionless water. This is Sandstrom's theorem.
Is that true in the presence of large-scale wind stresses?
I think that's why it says the deep ocean and not the surface ocean.
It's still in principle true for the theorem is more general. It's just if you heat and cool at the same pressure, you can't create a hurricane. So that's generally true.
But essentially, it obtains in the case for the zero viscosity. Mm-hmm. So that's why the wind-driven circulation doesn't.
Yeah.
There's no viscosity.
So anyway, the basic point is that these gravity waves, even though they're unresolved, very small scale, energetically not the most important part of the ocean's energy budget, are still playing a critical role in maintaining the thermohaline circulation, which is of crucial climatic significance. And so the next question, as I mentioned, is how are the internal gravity waves powered? Because whichever mechanism is generating the internal waves, it's the same mechanism which is powering the mixing, which is replenishing the ocean's potential energy against the sinks. This is a famous diagram for oceanographers. I'm not going to go through it in detail. It's quite involved, from a paper in 2004. The boxes along the top here are sources and sinks of energy for the global ocean circulation, tides, winds, so on. The grey boxes are storage terms, essentially, the general circulation, eddies, internal waves. And there are all sorts of complicated pathways between all of these terms. I want to focus on what generates the internal waves, as I've motivated.
What are these?
Watt, joule, and E joule? Terawatts and exajoules. All the fluxes here are in terawatts. Is that your question?
Yeah.
So it's 3.5 terawatts and 0.1 terawatts, and the energy is exajoules, which is 10 to the... Someone?
What's a Y joule?
What's
the Y? Oh, the octajoule. That's, I think, 1,000 exajoules.
Pretty sure they just made that.
That, I guess, is it 10 to 21? I don't know. I can't remember. It seems very big anyway, of course. I think 1,000 turas are an exa, and 1,000 exas is a yotta.
What are the sort of the uncertainties in these numbers?
Most of these numbers have large uncertainties. In fact, if you read the caption to this figure, there are factors, errors as large as factors of 10 in most of these numbers. This is a sort of approximate picture. It's pretty hard to get at most of these fluxes. Lots of them are labeled with question marks.
But is this, I mean, somehow these boxes require some sort of scale separation between the different scales and so on. Is it really well defined?
I don't think so. Yeah, I think so. I mean, there are caveats in the caption to the figure, which probably address that. But it's pretty unambiguous what the general circulation is, what the eddies are.
Well, I mean, I don't know if this is exactly what you're saying, but there is a question, which is, for a long time, people were trying to find the missing mechanism, and they were very good at that, the missing mixing mechanism. They've been so good at it, we now have a whole bunch of different mixing mechanisms. If you add them all up, it's more than the necessary mixing. Right. And then there's a question of whether they're really additive or not. And you can't mix something twice. So, I don't know if it's scale separation, but there is sort of process separation here.
Right.
Might they all be there, but actually you just can't keep mixing things too many times.
Absolutely. And I'm, in fact, going to add to the headache, because I'm going to suggest another mechanism, unfortunately.
Good. Well, because my talk tomorrow will discuss yet another one. So.
Right. Okay. There we go.
It'll be even better. More mixing.
We should talk about that. But anyway, I'm looking at the mechanisms which inject energy into the internal waves. Right? That's the important thing. And the tides do. So the east to west sloshing of ocean basins in response to the moon and the sun. Generate internal waves at the base of the ocean, where there's topography. Okay, this injects 0.1 terawatts, according to this figure. The winds as well, we've mentioned that. Simple direct forcing, wind stress forcing by the atmosphere on the ocean generates not only surface waves, but internal waves, 0.6 terawatts, apparently. This is the sort of wacky suggestion from Bill Dewar and his colleagues that fish swimming around in the ocean. And they've quantified this flux as pretty big. I mean, it's, I think, the tenth of a terawatt or something.
But that was just based on one near coastal observation.
Yeah,
it's pretty hard to extrapolate from there to the ocean.
Right. So I haven't put their number on. But anyway, they reckon that there's an appreciable injection of energy here. So looking at the box here, we've dealt with the winds, tides, marine life. There's only one other input mechanism into internal waves, and that is the flux from mesoscale eddies. It's got a question mark next to it. It's labeled loss of balance, and it's this energy flux here, which was regarded by Winch and Ferrari to be of unknown importance, if you read their paper. Okay, it's got a question mark next to it. So oceanographers have a long sort of tended to forget about this pathway, actually, but long wondered whether this pathway might be an important source of energy. This is a difficult question to answer, but it's a question I'm going to try to answer. How can we quantify this pathway? There are theories around slow manifold theories. Slow manifold is the sub-manifold of phase space upon which there are no fast gravity waves. But these theories, in order to make them analytically tractable, contain all sorts of ad hoc approximations, and one worries, and I'll show an example if I have time, an example of where these slow manifold theories go very, very wrong.
So you do have a separation between waves and eddies.
Yeah.
Is that a scale separation?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's great, and that's fine.
Yeah. I think there's a very clear separation between the eddies and the waves. Someone will correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah.
And it's waves, you're talking about gravity waves, but I think usually waves are linear things and eddies are generally anything that can be linear or non-linear. We tend to use it. So waves are, waves don't necessarily transport stuff, but eddies do.
And then waves break, and then you have no
linear, and then it's
It's tough.
And numerical models aren't necessarily good either, but I'm going to propose that we can learn about this loss of balance energy pathway in a laboratory experiment. Because I'm running out of time and wanted to be farther ahead than I am, I'll skip, I think, to the results. So in this laboratory experiment, I hope this will make sense having skipped those slides, but we can watch how the mesoscale flow, balanced large-scale flow in the laboratory experiment. This is time, by the way. This is the amplitude of the balanced flow, essentially a mesoscale eddy in this terminology. Loses energy in time and actually leaks away its energy into the inertial gravity waves by a process known as loss of balance. Haven't really talked about that, but it's sort of generalization of the classic Rossby geostrophic adjustment process. In geostrophic adjustment, you take an ocean surface that looks like that, and you let it evolve in time, and it ends up being geostrophically balanced, but it's emitted two trains of gravity waves in the process. It turns out, though, that even long after the initial condition adjustment, fluids can spontaneously lose balance and generate gravity waves.
What's in here?
Sorry, this is height.
Okay.
This is just sea surface. This is, in the Rossby model, this is sea surface height. So we can watch this process of loss of balance and spontaneous, we've got good evidence that these gravity waves in the lab are generated by this so-called spontaneous adjustment, loss of balance mechanism. And we can watch how they grow in time, and we can come up with a number, the rate of energy growth, the rate at which energy leaks from the large-scale flow, the slow manifold, into the fast manifold, which contains the gravity waves. And we observe that every day in turntable land, every time the turntable, which is rotating, goes around once, a large scale flow has leaked away 1% of its energy, its total potential plus kinetic energy, into the gravity waves. This is a number that's almost impossible to arrive at from numerical models and theories, but we get it here in the lab.
It depends on Rossby number.
It does. So I'll come, as soon as you've asked, I'll come straight to that. We can look at flows with different Rossby numbers. It's not particularly clear here, but the gravity waves clearly grow with Rossby number, and there is a large... So these slow manifold theories all make predictions about how the gravity wave amplitude should scale with Rossby number. Some theory suggests an exponential decay with Rossby number. That's these solid lines. Okay, these suggest that as you shrink the Rossby number, the energy or the amplitude of the gravity wave should shrink to zero exponentially quickly. There are other theories that say that it should be...
What's your definition of Rossby number here? Just as a scale is
it's the... it's defined from... So there's a I didn't say any of this, but there's a lid at the top of this experiment that's rotating.
You should say a little bit more about the experiment. Yeah. It's hard to follow.
Right, sorry. Okay, let me say some more then. Well, this is a photograph of it in Oxford. We shine light in from the bottom. It comes up through the annular tank. It's picked up by this camera at the top. That's just looking in from above. And this is just a schematic of it. So it's a two-layer fluid. Weakly stratified on a rotating turntable. There's a super rotating lid that's driving baroclinic instability. And we're looking at waves on this interface. One of these liquids is optically active.
So the cylinders are not rotating?
Sorry, say again?
The cylinders are not rotating?
They are. They're rotating with the turntable, and the lid is rotating differentially with respect to the cylinder. That drives the baroclinic instability, which produces the large scale wave, which generates the small-scale gravity waves.
What's the density ratio?
It's about 0.5%. Uh, Anyway, so we can derive this curve in the lab, and it looks very different from these theoretical predictions. In fact, it's the scaling we see in the lab is linear scaling, not exponential decay. This is a critical result, actually, because slow manifold theorists, in fact, anyone who uses a QG or a filtered model in which the gravity waves are filtered out, they desperately need to rely on the fact that for Rossby numbers of the order of 0.1, the gravity wave field is very weak, exponentially weak, okay, because QG doesn't work for a flow with gravity waves in it. And these lab results suggest actually that the decay with Rossby number is not exponentially weak. The gravity waves are not exponentially weak at all, actually, they're only linearly weak. Okay, so.
Can you exclude that the walls of the tank affect these results?
We have thought about that very carefully, done some experiments, and we're about to have a student doing some more without the inner boundary, so just in an open cylinder, and the waves are still there. And there's a group actually in Grenoble, Lambert floor.
Works. Do they see a similar dependence on Rossby number?
They haven't measured that yet. We have
a reason why it's so just a difference in the error range. You can do it experimentally.
In the lab, for practical reasons, we can only get this factor of three, I think it is. If we go outside this, didn't talk about this very much either, but there's a calibration. We have to convert from these color pictures we get into interface height, and there's a calibration curve from which we do that, which we've derived, but if you go outside those Rossby numbers, you fall off the edge of the range for which we can calibrate it.
Are you using synthetic Schlieren or some technique like that?
No.
That might give you a more dynamic range. I mean, it's much easier to count it.
No, it's nothing like that. Yeah. So one of these layers, I'm sorry, I skipped over it. One of these layers is optically active. So there's a Polaroid filter here. The light that goes in is plane polarized. It's an interesting bit of physics, actually. But for a given depth of the optically active layer, there's another Polaroid in front of the camera, and only light of a certain wavelength will be rotated into alignment with that filter and will get through. So that's why these pictures, there's a correlation.
Is there a camera on the side?
It's the side walls aren't transparent, so we're working on that too. Anyway, so blue here means a high interface height, and yellow means a low interface height. And we can derive the calibration curves. Here they are. So this uses hue, which is a measure of the dominant wavelength. You can split up red, green, and blue color space into hue, saturation, intensity. And these are the calibration curves. So yellow means a low interface height, blue means a high interface height, and we have a pretty reliable calibration curve. So we can go from pictures like this to reconstruct what the interface looks like. Didn't want to go into any of that, really, but I hope it's answered the questions. And so the other thing then is, given this laboratory observation that when we have mesoscale flow in the laboratory, it leaks 1% of its energy per day, per rotation period into the internal waves. Let's suppose that the ocean behaves in the same way because the Rossby numbers are the same, and that seems to be the critical parameter. Froude numbers and the Berger numbers are also the same, as you point out. Let's take 13 exajoules, the energy in the mesoscale eddies, and take 1% of it per day, and that allows us to calculate the flux. And you come up with, if you take 1% of 13 exajoules and divide it by 24 hours, you come up with a flux of 1.5 terawatts. So that's our estimate of this energy pathway. It's larger, but the same order of magnitude as some of these others.
I'm sorry, how did you decide the time scale for determining the flux?
So in the laboratory, every time the turntable goes around once, so one day, essentially, one rotation of the coils, it's 1% of the energy that gets leaked away from the large-scale flow into the gravity wave. So we assume it's the same in the ocean.
Does that imply a lifetime for mesoscale eddies that is within the realm of observed?
Yeah. If an eddy is decaying at a rate of 1% a day, the lifetime is of the order of 100, 200 years. Days, of course. Yeah, which is reasonable. Yeah. And I've said all of that. So remember, this is all happening because of these gravity waves, which are unresolved in general circulation models, and yet they're playing a critical role in injecting the energy that maintains the ocean stratification against the processes, the deep water formation that tends to reduce it. Come up with this number of 1%, which is a function of the Rossby number, but Rossby numbers of the order of 0.1, about 1%, and we get this 1.5 terawatts. But, you know, ocean GCMs are very good in actually simulating the spatial pattern of the thermohaline circulation, zonal mean overturning, and that's because even though these the internal waves are playing a critical role, actually they're amenable to parameterization. You know, there's a the Fickian diffusion hypothesis. You can assume that the vertical mixing is just acting as a diffusion, a del squared sort of mixing in the vertical with the diapicnal coordinate. And so, you know, the good news in the case of the ocean is that even though the gravity waves are unresolved by the GCM, we can parameterize them effectively, and we get a pretty good ocean circulation coming out of it. I'm now going to show very, very...
But here you have a gravity wave. You don't know how much is produced mixing. That's what is needed to do the work.
Well, all the flux that goes into the gravity wave eventually goes into mixing when the waves break.
Well, no, the gravity could be dissipated by even smaller scale, which is not caused by mixing. Yeah. It just goes kinetic energy dissipated.
I think that's
so what you need a breaking. Otherwise, how can you...
Kinetic energy dissipation in the end is mixing. You just have...
Yeah, but no, but that's not the one generating potential energy. That's a problem.
Yeah, I mean, that's
it needs breaking to generate potential energy.
Generating potential
to produce diapicnal mixing.
Generating potential energy, I think, is maybe not the best way of putting it anyway.
You do need to, because otherwise, how can you get a diapicnal mixing? Because that's the key. If you don't have mixing, you just have linear wave.
Yes.
It wouldn't produce that.
It's true in the lab that the breaking does not occur.
Yeah, see, I'm wondering under what condition you can generate breaking. That would be really interesting.
Right. So the breaking doesn't occur in the lab because, well, of a number of effects. I mean, surface tension, these liquids are immiscible, there's not continuous transportation. But under the assumption, and I think it's a reasonable one, that all of the energy that goes into the generating the waves eventually goes into vertical mixing, then...
Well, it needs breaking, like you said at the beginning. If you don't have breaking, how can you... This is downgrading, it doesn't even produce...
Mm-hmm. It's crucial. I mean, as long as waves of small amplitudes, they don't really mix. I mean, you need to go sometimes to force water by
that's
you,
the difficult
without breaking.
That's my question. If that's you
wanna,
part.
If you wanna yeah. mix it, because
that's
they just
because in this case you can have a scenario, large scale or small scale or gravity wave, then this satisfied by let's say molecular scale, whatever.
Right.
It doesn't go back to address the original question.
Right? But
I think also is the mixing 10 minus 4, which is a 5 order, then the molecular diffusivity. That's the question. How do you generate this mixing?
Yeah.
Five orders magnitude larger than molecular diffusivity.
Under the
That's all.
Can I answer it to yourself, I guess? But I think your assumptions are reasonable in that you assume that however they dissipate in the end in detail, that of course varies on. Depending on all sorts of what happens on these small scales that you don't necessarily have, but whatever flux goes into gravity waves eventually dissipates. That's pretty clear, and there's not much backscatter as the assumption. And I think that's fair. You can assume that whatever flux goes into those waves is eventually being dissipated, and that's really all you need here.
If you don't have
it's not dissipated in the right place.
It's not in the right place.
Well, you're talking not, you're not talking about bare in the thermal time, whatever, it's dissipating. That's not the question you're trying to address here.
If it's dissipating and you think of that as a thermal flux somewhere, if it's a thermal flux at the warm end, it doesn't help you. It has to be a thermal flux at the cold end. Otherwise, it's not
changing. That's a question of the stratification and how this exactly occurs. It's just not a false question.
I'd like to move on if you don't mind, because there's more to get through. But of course, this comes with caveats, and it's a crude
extrapolation. It's interesting. It's
the first ever estimate of that flux from the laboratory experiment. Yeah. So I think it adds to the debate. I'm not saying there are no error bars on that estimate.
I know you want to move on, but it's really interesting. I have one quick question. If you would just put an obstacle in your annulus so that you have gravity wave generation by topography, can you increase the loss of balance that way?
We've never done experiments like that. I imagine... I don't want to speculate in case I'm wrong, but I would say you certainly generate more gravity waves. There's an enormous debate in Seattle a couple of years ago at a meeting about how we should define balance and how we should define loss of balance, and we went on for hours and hours, and it's a subtle concept. So whether you lose, you break the balance or not is, I don't think there's an easy answer to that. You certainly generate more gravity waves and there'd be more flux into the, but whether that's broken the balance is hard to say. And now we're going to talk for about 2 minutes about my atmospheric case study. Thanks to Thomas Berner, who's in the atmospheric or in the physics department at Toronto University.
We have the room till 11:30, so
I don't want to. Well, I'll go through this very quickly. So this is another lesson from the lab. So this is a lab experiment which exhibits regimes, wave number regimes. There are multiple equilibria, different baroclinic waves of different wave number all compete with each other, and eventually one is selected. Here it's a wave 2, because if you went round a constant radius, you'd have a crest, a trough, a crest and a trough. That's a wave 1. Anyway, there are regimes in this experiment, and we observed that in flows without gravity waves, the wave 2 just sits there indefinitely, rotating around. But in flows with gravity waves, and you can see them here, every now and then the flow spontaneously undergoes a transition to a different regime. And so we have in mind for this, running out of space, but an energy landscape that looks like this. I call this a noise-induced transition. This is the sort of classical view of noise-induced transition. The system is in this state, and there's some noise that kicks it out into the other state. Of course, it's not really noise here. It's a signal. It's these gravity waves. They've got structure to them. But they are apparently behaving, from the point of view of the larger scale flow, as if they were noise, by apparently forcing this transition. And to further convince you of that, we have, in 2003, developed a model of this laboratory experiment, and when we run it without any noise in it, the wave 2 just sits as it is. But when we put in a random noise term on the right-hand side of the quasi-geostrophic potential vorticity equations, which is the crude stochastic gravity wave parameterization, we see this transition, just like we see in the lab, from the starting point, which is wave 2, eventually to wave 1. So we can mimic what we see in the lab by representing the gravity wave stochastically.
You needed to jump back again?
No, if this is deeper than this, then this is the global minimum.
So the exponential, the long wind time, is it feasible to run the experiment at
all? Well, I think you might have to run it for centuries. So
well,
I don't know. I've never seen them. My guess is that this well is much deeper than this well, so once it gets there.
What kind of noise do you use?
Uncorrelated gassing noise, yeah.
But in your experiment, what do you mean, the gravity wave, that's generated internally, or it's just you?
Yeah, they're internal, spontaneously adjacent. Yeah, yeah. Anyway, I was giving a seminar about this topic in Reading in 2004 when Thomas Berner was in the audience. He was a postdoc at Reading at the time, and he pointed out the very strong qualitative resemblance between what we see there in the lab and what we see more or less every year in the Arctic polar vortex, which is this split. These are separated by days in the winter of 2001. You see, there, you get a strong picture here that this is a system with two regimes, one which looks like this, one which is the split state, and there's a sort of rapid transition between the two. We saw in 2002 the same thing happening in the Antarctic polar vortex. It's the first time we've seen it happen in 50 years of observations. Actually, it happens much more frequently in the Arctic than the Antarctic. These are also called sudden stratospheric warmings, by the way, because all this warm subpolar air gets rushed up to the stratospheric pole. Anyway, same thing here. You see this split to this new regime very rapidly. And so we just wondered, Thomas and I, after this talk I gave, whether there was a possible interpretation of these sudden stratospheric warmings or polar vortex splits as being noise-induced transitions. Let's get over all of the details. We use a simple model which has these two states. Okay, we're using a three-component model with 3 degrees of freedom, one of which has a stable state which looks like the pre-vortex split state. And there's another stable state, which is the post-vortex split statum as a range of this parameter H, the planetary wave forcing, for which there's bistability. Both of these are stable. The conventional interpretation of sudden stratospheric warmings is that the planetary wave activity, you're sitting up here and you reach this critical bifurcation point and you drop off into the wave state. We wondered whether, even if H didn't reach this bifurcation point, if you're sitting up here, is it possible for noise to induce a transition down to the wave state? That's the basic question, inspired by the lab observations. And because I'm running out of time, I'm just going to say that the answer is yes. We add noise, and we start the system in radiative state without any noise. We switch on the noise, wobbles around a bit, and eventually it undergoes a transition to the wave state. This noise, of the order of a meter per second per day, is reasonable. People who like gravity wave drag parameterizations tell me that the gravity waves drag the zonal mean zonal flow with this sort of deceleration. So it's a proof of concept, but it does suggest that there may be a possible interpretation of this process as a noise-induced transition.
How do the hysteresis go back and jump up?
Yeah, so in this model, the reverse transition is not captured. Once it gets into the vortex split state, it doesn't spontaneously go back.
Just because you've got the slide there, what do you know about your first passage time distribution at the moment? I mean, even at this level.
This is what it is. That's what it looks like. After 1,000 integrations, all with different realizations of the noise, it would make sense to put a log of it, actually. It's got a long tail.
Yeah.
But anyway, distribution. I don't know if you have any insights into why it should look like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's interesting to plot the median first passage time as a function of the noise, because what the stratospheric dynamicists are interested in is whether you will see one of these transitions in a given winter. And it turns out that for these sort of values of noise, this is the median, so there's a 50% chance of seeing a noise-induced transition for these parameters within 100 days, which is interesting. Here we're at H equals 200, lambda equals 1, which is lambda equals 1, H equals 200, so we're about here. So not at the deterministic bifurcation point. I think I'll sum up there. One more thing is that we can solve the Fokker-Planck equation for this system. So start out in the radiative state and watch how our probability cloud evolves in time. Eventually, you find it over here. This is integrated over U to give a two-dimensional probability density function, looping over into the wave state. Right, and that's all I want to say, really. I've sort of said all of these things and about the fact that this motivates stochastic parameterization. It's not very likely, it seems to me, that deterministic gravity wave drag parameterizations could capture this. It seems much more likely that stochastic parameterization will be useful. And to that end, I just want to give a quick plug. Tim Palmer and I have been editing for the past year or so a special volume of Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society on the subject of stochastic physics and climate modeling. And in fact, the collection is going to be published by Cambridge as a book as well later this year. So I just wanted to plug that, and I can say more about it if any of you are interested. But my hour is up, so sorry if it's going on a bit too long, and thanks for your attention.
You probably knew this, Paul, when you were at Toronto, but there's the group working in data simulation with the Canadian Elasticsphere model that you could investigate maybe a little more quantitatively some of these questions of by putting in and taking out sources of gravity waves in the data simulation scheme.
So Thomas and I are thinking about writing a proposal to look at these things in a more realistic model, which is clearly, you know, you worry about sometimes some of these things being artifacts.
There's a lot of focus on you know, certain events, and it's not all sudden warming. There's other things you could look at in the same framework and going on right now. So
right, yeah, we plan to work more on it together in the future.
So I'd also like to turn the problem upside down and say, if you have a scale separation and you have small scale processes, the first guess would of course be that you could just stochastic noise. You always force stochastic noise. So what would be the physical limitations for when can you not do that? When is it not possible to just treat it as random noise.
You mean if the scale separation doesn't exist?
I mean, obviously, scale separation is, cloud processes, there's clear scale separation to the large scales. So there'd be situations where you have a scale separation and where the true detailed dynamics of the small scale process this man, was it simply just a question of knowing the intensity of the noise on the large scale, on the grid scale?
Mm-hmm. I can't think of a single example of a time for which you would not want to. I mean, I think there would always be a motivation for adding noise, whether the scale separation is there or not.
I suppose it's akin to random place approximation, so it's when that rate variable.
Yeah, are there any resonant
problems in the system? I'd rather like to refer to that because that's like a wave particle interaction with the thin wave or the squat wave being the particle.
Yeah.
The strategy, for example, you can make a case that it's unlikely that deterministic parameterizations will capture this kind of behavior. It may be true that stochastic parameterizations do better, but I think that this example may not be the best to make that case, and that the waves that probably induce these transitions are large-scale waves, planetary waves, more than gravity waves, most likely. And those are, as we tend to model deterministically, in fact, they can be resolved. And
right.
High resolution models, so this breakup of the vortex might even be something that you can resolve in the GCM once it has reasonable vertical resolution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You certainly can resolve the waves in the GCM. I mean, without
the waves, you can
have your simple GCM set. Can give you sudden warnings, and there's the lots to work on that. But I guess the idea is that. Some of these things might be really sensitive to, say, what's happening in the mesosphere where the gravity wave activity is really strong, and sometimes it's observed that the sudden warming events are initiated up there. So there might be it might not be the simplest model, but it might be the next adjustment to the kind of classical golden mass theory that might involve this.
Yeah, I mean, I know this, but you also know that just because you see something propagating down there,
there's independent evidence that gravity wave forcing is a transition. There's observational evidence. There's observational evidence that gravity wave forcing is important in some of these sub-warmings. That's of course, yeah.
Maybe another
where they start is not relevant.
Yeah.
It's a proof of concept. I'm not saying anything rigorous.
It's
suggestive of the need for future work. That's the point.
And even if it's gravity waves, we have rules for how they propagate and they dissipate. So I'm not against stochastic perturbation. In fact, I think that will be very useful, but I think you can rule out something deterministic.
It's certainly true in the lab that deterministic parameterization doesn't. I mean, we can turn out the friction, the dissipation, is a quasi drag parameterization, and it doesn't. You don't get the transition because this structure remains intact. It's the noise that pushes it over.
Another comment on this ocean mixing, and I think you're aware of this, it's just passions run high whenever you talk about mixing in the ocean, and we'll see some of that here. But so you were giving these bulk estimates, and I think for that, that's fine. The question is, how much do you really need to know about the mixing in the ocean to capture what we care most about in ocean dynamics, which is primarily the ocean heat transport? And to the extent that the ocean heat transport happens in the upper ocean, where there's plenty of mixing from all sorts of sources, straight wind mixing, we may not have to talk about the details of how energy is scattered into small-scale modes. These small-scale modes surely matter for the thermohaline circulation, but the deep circulation, you still need the mixing.
Mm-hmm.
But the question is how much of that you need to understand climate, and that's, I think, less clear.
I agree.
Some indicator when you place that much emphasis on the mixing, you start to talk about the mixing with tuna. That's some indication that land isn't silly land.
Yeah, I agree. It's not clear that there are huge implications for climate modelling here, but there might be some. Thinking about, I don't know whether people think ocean eddies are projected to become more vorticity in the future climate, or I mean, so you can see that if we, it is valuable to know that this is the curve on which these things lie rather than these curves, I think.
Also, I wouldn't sell yourself short. I mean, when you double the vertical mixing in a model with small vertical mixing, background mixing, it depends on the model, but you might increase ocean heat transport by 50%.
Because these climate models are all very gooey. That's
well, insofar as we know the answer, it actually does make a big difference what the vertical mixing is.
Yeah, I mean, if you actually measure mixing in the open ocean, it's much less than what is in climate models. And if you try to build a climate model, it'll mixing.
Right.
As I said, of course, function, it gets you heat transports about right. So it's,
I mean, even the stability of the THC is quite a sensitive function for vertical mixing. If you turn it up and down, you can switch the bistability off.
Right, yeah.
It's an important
process. Yeah, it's used, and the thing is, in the current climate model construction, people are just going ahead and doing it and using whatever studies justify how to proceed. So they're using these knobs to tune the mean circulation in their coupled climate models. Mm-hmm. So the more study, the better.
Yeah. It's worth saying, and I didn't mention it, we have a theory which predicts this linear scaling, which is a slaving theory based on some paper on renormalization techniques a few years ago. So we can, and the theory does predict other aspects of the laboratory generation very well as well, like the spatial locations and the amplitudes and the wavelengths. So we sort of, this is work in progress, it's not published yet, but we think we have a pretty good grasp of the mechanism.
I'm wondering how is your lessening your tank experiment? How is the gravity wave generated? Is it because of just non-linear interaction between the vertical modes?
That's my question.
No, they're not shear waves. We can compute the Richardson number, and it's of order 10, 20.
Yeah, so, but the thing is that you do have a preferred, some like small scale. In principle, the gravity wave, you can have large scale too. I mean, just close to F, you know, so the frequency is close to F, right, mm-hmm. inertial oscillation. So, but in your case, you tend to have some preferred scale. Mm-hmm. And so maybe that is also kind of if you think about geotropic adjustment, you're going to generate some gravity waves anyway. But what is not clear, like, you know, we're talking about why there's a scale, then you can separate. So if the mechanism is clear, then that will give a much better, understanding of this, So I'm wondering what's your thought on this.
Yeah, so according to this theory that I didn't talk about, I mean, the answer to your question, what selects the scales?
Yeah.
I mean, there are different answers I can give. One is this condition I talked about, the phase velocity of the large scale matching the
small scale. Some kind of resonance.
Right.
Okay.
But according to this slaving theory I talked about, it's because the non-linear, so the slaving theory involves projecting the inertial gravity wave eigenmodes onto the non-linearity of the quasi-geostrophic equations. Mm-hmm. And waves of that scale that get selected have a high projection onto the non-linearity of the QG equations. To give you, that's a very, very brief thing.
Can you show us your three equations?
Mm-hmm. In fact, they're due to Rushmikin, I think, here.
Right, yes.
In the Dynamos program.
Is it
in
both programs?
In both programs, okay. Not.
He's spending most of his time at I know the first one.
So X and Y are the real and imaginary parts of a complex stream function, the wave 2 stream function. And U is the zonal mean zonal flow, and there's this quadratic nonlinearity between the zonal mean flow and the waves. It's an energy conserving, if you take XX dot and add it to YY dot, remembering that XX dot is X squared dot, it's the energy, it's just cast out. So it's an energy conserving quadratic.
You have multiplication and additive modes?
No, just additive at the moment, though Thomas and I are looking at using multiplicative noise as well, but at the moment we've just added additive noise to the equation for the zonal mean, zonal flow imaginary representation of drag of the zonal mean.
So there was this long discussions some 10 years ago about bimodality in the large-scale atmospheric ocean, so slipped away. Montagne, there were all these discussions, but there is more data, and it became mutable.
Right.
So it's sort of surprising that you get a picture like this from data that you have to most of you.
Adam Monahan, in one of his papers, has a plot from Linas data in some normal mode from principal component space, which looks like that, and it's bimodal from observations. I don't know exactly what, I'll have to read the papers to check exactly which what he was looking at.
Yeah, so Trump is very close, so he's
getting
on
So if we believe in this, I mean, this sort of energy, I guess it's really not an energy landscape here. You plot the vertical axis is something like minus log of the probability.
Right.
Because, I mean, it's hard to, this is what energy is doing there. So what your noise is doing in for the small scale is really changing the probability so that you can cross through the barrier with high probability. Mm-hmm. So I'm just wondering how you sort of put this kind of picture that you get from sort of glassy states or whatever into wave patterns like that, mm-hmm. because it's not really like crossing an energy barrier.
Right.
I guess.
Right. I don't know if it's an energy barrier. I don't know. I mean, I guess it's possible to derive this shape, this potential.
For
any
equation, you could do that.
Right. Maybe that would be interesting to do.
It's more like a stability crossing. A different wave number becomes unstable, and a higher wave number becomes unstable, and the vortex breaks up.
But it's more, I mean, in my view, it's more like, I mean, you find sort of a path in phase space, right? You have some paths that are less vulnerable and so on, and you sort of find your way through there. That's sort of different physically from crossing an energy barrier.
Right, I mean, there are two tracks.
Take this, the probability density, turn it upside down, get this.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Yeah.